Thank you very much, Denny. Great to be here with all of you today. This time of year is a difficult time for a lot of people. I've had it impressed on my mind recently that people are troubled with one cold, cloudy day after another, one long, cold, dark night after another. Since the time change we had a couple of weeks ago, several people have mentioned how it bothers them when it seems like it gets dark in the middle of the afternoon and the long evenings make them blue. That's not unusual. It happens every year. We are influenced by the things around us. We're impacted by them. And it reminds me of a situation in the life of David before he was king in 1 Samuel chapter 27. So I'd like to talk with you about that today because David got depressed. And it's not our desire to chide David because he became depressed. There's nothing ethically, spiritually, or morally wrong with cloudy days and dark nights, whether we're speaking physically of the world around us or what's going on inside of us. These are inevitable. I think that's one reason the writer James says, count it all joy when you fall into various trials. Not if you do, but when you do. Because this is inevitable. Our concern with David is what happened to him, what decisions he made when he became depressed. And he let this lead on to other things that were worse. So in 1 Samuel chapter 27, we look at a specific event, and the first thing we see there is, David said in his heart. That means he's talking to himself. And that's not unusual either. I don't think there's a human being alive who doesn't talk to himself or herself. We all do it. The problem is, when you talk to yourself, it's very important that you say the right things. Say things that are true. And David does what we so often might do when we talk to ourselves. He tells himself a lie. Do you do that? It's a rare person who does not at least occasionally tell himself a lie when he talks to himself. I shall now perish one day by the hand of Saul. Now, David knew better than that. And in his better moments, he knew better than that. In his times of optimism and realism, he knew better than that. But David is a very sensitive man. We can tell this from reading the Psalms. George read a while ago from the 102nd Psalm. We had a reading from the 63rd Psalm by Paul a while ago. We experience every emotion that there is, the whole range and the extremes of both ranges, when we read the feelings of David in the Psalms. And so he allowed his sensitivity to lead him in a direction in his thinking that he should not have gone. He knew that he is going to be king someday, but instead he tells himself that I am going to perish. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood. There was a fork in the road and David took the wrong fork. And the result is predictable. Misery, compromise, 16 long months of disobedience. He says to himself, I'm going to perish. This shows that at this time in his life, he's got a humanistic viewpoint. He's not looking at things from a God's eye point of view. He's looking at it just purely in a self-centered manner. And he never looks up toward God until much further down the line. We don't find that happening until chapter 30, and I want to skip over there later before I stop talking. I want to skip over to chapter 30 and see some optimism and some good things happening for David. But it takes a long time for that to unfold because he's reasoning humanistically here. He's coming off several great spiritual and emotional highs. He could have killed Saul twice, but he refrained from that. This was a rigorous discipline, and it was a good thing. He was about to kill Nabal, but Abigail stood in the way and said, David, it's not wisest for you to do that. And he submitted to that realistic thinking. He has had a lot of good things going on, and that can be a very vulnerable spot. He falls into pessimistic reasoning. He knew better than that, but he let himself do it anyway because it must have felt good to him to do that. I think too often we allow ourselves to slip into pessimistic reasoning when we really know better as well. We're talking about the future, and we inevitably sometimes let ourselves get to the bleak side. Here Samuel has anointed David as the next king. He has said to David, you're going to be the next king. Abigail has told David, you're going to be the next king. His best friend Jonathan, Saul's son, has said, you're going to be the next king. Even Saul himself. David, I know when I look at you, I'm seeing my successor. David knew all this, but he denied it all in his own mind. I'll never see the kingdom. I'll never be king. Just because it kind of felt good to feel sorry for himself for a while. One time many years ago, I read a book by a medical doctor called How to Live 365 Days a Year. I want to read to you just one little vignette that he wrote about a rich farmer that he knew. This was up north where the days get long and cold, also up in Wisconsin. This was about a rich farmer that he knew, and he was interested in that man's personality and psychic makeup. I had asked Sam's family and neighbors whether they'd ever heard Sam say a hopeful, pleasant word, and not one of them ever had. His wife thinks Sam did say something pleasant in the first year of their marriage, but that was so long ago she's no longer sure. To illustrate how Sam's disposition operates, I drove into his farm one day in July, just about the time the oats were ready to be cut. Sam had 60 acres of the nicest oats you'd ever want to see. I said, Sam, that's a wonderful field of oats you've got there. Sam said mournfully, yeah, but the wind will blow it down before I get it cut. I watched the oats. Sam got it cut before the wind blew it down. He got it threshed before it burned up. I knew he received a good price for the oats, so the next time I saw Sam, I said, Sam, how'd the oats turn out? Oh, I suppose good enough, he said, but a crop of oats like that sure takes a lot out of the soil. Another year he had corn that ran 165 bushels to the acre. Before it was harvested, Sam was in my office and I was saying, how's the corn this year, Sam? He said, it's terrible. It's so heavy, I don't know how we'll ever get in there and get it cut. Another time in October, I met him on the street. It was one of those beautiful October dream days in Wisconsin. And with what I thought was a contagious enthusiasm, I said, hello, Sam. Wonderful day, isn't it? Sam said, yeah, but when we get it, we'll get it hard. We laugh because it's close. It's close to us, isn't it? Why are we like that? Why are we like that? I guess we're afraid of being disappointed. We're afraid of being hurt. But somehow we can very easily turn toward pessimism. Sometimes maybe it's because our eyes are on ourselves too much. There's also rationalization in David's thinking here. Since I know I'm not going to be the next king in spite of all the promises, David goes on and says, there's nothing better for me to do than I should speedily escape into the land of the Philistines. And when I do, Saul shall despair of me to seek me any more out of the coast of Israel. So I shall escape out of his hand. Now this is the giant killer talking. David has already defeated Goliath. He knows that God had given them the victory in that case. But it's hard to believe that he's making this statement now. This is rationalization. Times are hard. I thought I'd be king, but I'll never be king. I'm going to die if I just keep one jump ahead of Saul. He's chasing me everywhere. He's got the army of Israel on his side. Every time I fall down, I get up a little slower. I'm getting worse and worse. So I've got to escape. I've got to go to Philistia. The Philistines were the arch enemies of Israel. They were David's archenemies. The women have said Saul has killed his thousands, but David has killed his tens of thousands. Now he's going to go over to the enemy side. This is a picture of a believer who opts for a carnal way of life. David is an illustration of a believer who's a believer on the inside, but on the outside he starts looking just like a non-believer. Because he's choosing a lifestyle that's non-believer-ish. It was like being a non-Christian. I'll go down to Philistia. Rollo May, the well-known psychologist, said, man is the strangest of all animals. He's the only animal that runs faster when he's lost. And I've noticed with myself, if I'm out on the road, I get lost, I drive faster so I can find something that looks like it will orient me, so I can figure out where I am. It's very strange. Just the opposite of most of the rest of God's creation. We've got Blue Ridge Boulevard over here, but it used to be a wagon trail. And before it was a wagon trail, it was a deer trail. You've seen a deer come along a trail quietly. And if it gets disoriented, if it hears a sound, if it needs to stop and reorient, it will stop. It'll stop and stand there silently. It'll turn its head from place to place, cock its ears from place to place. But it doesn't just start running like I do if I'm lost. It reorients itself and then it goes on in a purposeful manner. Now, some people think that when they run in one direction or the other because they're lost, that it'll only affect them. After all, it doesn't affect anybody else. They'll say, it's nobody but me. It's my own decision. I'll choose my route and I'll take my lumps with God when that time comes. One of the problems with that kind of thinking is you drag other people along with you, sometimes not even realizing it. Nobody lives to himself. Nobody dies to himself. Nobody sins to himself either. Verse 2 here says, David arose and he passed over with the 600 men that were with him. These men have been trained by David. They've been cared for by David. They've done battle with David. Of course they're going to go with him. When you make this kind of a decision, it does not just affect you. He's trained these men and they have an allegiance to him. And that's not the end of it. Verse 3, David dwelt with Achish, who was the Philistine king, at Gath, which was the home of Goliath, by the way. He and his men, and every man with his household, even David with his two wives, Ahinoam and the Jezreelitess, and Abigail the Carmelitess, who had been Nabal's wife. So you've got 600 men plus 600 households and his wives, and it bears home to our minds that you can't compromise. You can't go into the enemy territory like this without taking that course rather extensively among the people who trust you and look to you and count on you and believe in you. When Abraham went down to Egypt, Sarah went right along with him. So we don't just make these kind of decisions on our own. The place where Goliath was from is now David's home with Achish the king, who's the archenemy of the Israelites. And David starts to have some consequences of this decision very soon. First of all, he's got a false sense of security there because he thinks he's safe in Philistia. The immediate pressure is gone. Saul's not chasing him into enemy territory. So it seems like a relief. A little bit about the choice, like the choice that Moses had to suffer affliction with the people of God or to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. Hebrews 11:25. Sin does have its pleasures. Disobedience can have its exhilarating moments. We're fools to deny that. But these pleasures and reliefs are always passing. They're always in transition and they never bring ultimate satisfaction ever. We might think the pleasures of sin for a season are just the overt pleasures, but sometimes it's just the release of pressure. When they say peace, peace, watch out because destruction is nigh, said the book. Here's the giant killer talking in verse 5. David said unto Achish, if I have now found grace in thine eyes, let them give me a place in some town in the country that I may dwell there. For why should thy servant dwell in the royal city with thee? David calls himself the servant of Achish, the Philistine king. He's submitting to an adversary cause. When you choose a carnal lifestyle because of your pessimism, don't expect to dash right back out of that. When Abraham went to Egypt, he stayed down there for a while. The same is true with David. He stays down here in Philistia. There's something magnetic about these kind of decisions. You don't always just dash right back out like maybe you thought you would when you begin a lifestyle that's like the lost world. You don't always just snap out of it even if you thought you would. When Abraham went down to Egypt, not only did he stay a while and Sarah stayed a while, but his nephew Lot, when he went to Sodom, began to pitch his tent near there, and before long he was living there, and finally Lot became one of the elders of the city of Sodom. I'm sure he never expected that, but that's how it wound up. He sat in the gate of Sodom and was identified with that wicked city. David is known as the sweet singer of Israel, but there's not one psalm attributed to David while he's staying with Achish down in Gath and later on in Ziklag. The sweet singer of Israel seems to have been mute during this slump. And in the carnal Christian life, there is a lack of productivity as well, and also a lack of joy, a sense of real joylessness, because you know, your conscience tells you, that same conscience Paul was talking about a while ago, tells you that you're not doing what you ought to do. Did Achish take David seriously? He seems to have done so. Over in chapter 29, verse 3, we find this. Then said the princes of the Philistines, "What do these Hebrews here? These Hebrews are our archenemies. Why are they here?" And Achish said unto the princes of the Philistines, "Is not this David, the servant of Saul, the king of Israel, that has been with me these days or these years? And I have found no fault in him since he fell unto me unto this day." Achish said, "David's doing just fine. He has defected. He has come over with us now." Achish seems completely convinced, because David is calling himself the servant of Achish. David seems to be completely in the camp of carnality, the carnal corral. And now the winds and the storms of life begin to increase as David has opted for this life. There is duplicity. Down in verse 8, the people of the Philistines are able to get David ejected from this area. They overrule Achish. Achish does not have absolute control, and the lords of the Philistines are able to cause David to be kicked out of the country of the Philistines. So now he's like a man without a country. I don't know if you ever read that little book or not. A man without a country, but he was put on a ship because he had given up his citizenship, and he just sailed on this ship all the time. Never went to a country because he didn't have a country. David has lived a life of duplicity. There has been deception by pretending here. On the inside, he's an Israelite and always will be, but he's pretending to be a Philistine who's fighting against the people of God, trying to live like a Philistine on the outside, and it creates a miserable dilemma. It creates the need to compromise and to cover up and to hide. There can't be any happiness if the things we do are different from the things we believe in. And David is trying to have it both ways. Down in verses 8 and 9, back in chapter 27, he went up and fought, invaded the country of the Geshurites and the Gezites and the Amalekites, those nations that were of old, the inhabitants of the land as thou goest to Shur, even down to Egypt. He's fighting neutral peoples and pretending that he's fighting the enemies of the Philistines and even fighting the Israelites itself. But really, he's fighting neutral people. They're enemies of Israel, but they're not the allies of Philistia, kind of like Russia in World War II. They were the enemies of Nazi Germany, but yet not really much of an ally of the U.S. And eventually David winds up down in Ziklag, which is the second southernmost city in the Promised Land, just above Beersheba. He's slaughtering neutral people, and he begins to be very vague in reporting his actions. He brings about a total extermination of these people because that way there won't be anybody around to tell what really happens. And David apparently considers himself accountable to Achish. Down in verse 9 of chapter 29, Achish answered and said unto David, "I know that you are good in my sight and as an angel of God. Notwithstanding, the princes of the Philistines have said he shall not go up with us to the battle. Wherefore now rise early in the morning and go with your master's servants that are with thee, and soon as you come up early in the morning and have light, depart." As soon as it's daylight, you need to get out of here. You know, back in verse 8, David didn't know what to do next. He says, "What have I done? What have you found in me that has not been according to your will all this time? Why can't I go up and fight with you?" So David is in a dilemma now. He even has lied a little. He didn't fight the people that he claims he has fought. He's been kicking over the traces, operating in secrecy. But Achish believed him. The lords of the Philistines didn't feel comfortable having him around. David has opted for a wrong fork in the road. He's bought into a lifestyle that has resulted in an incredible sense of turmoil within him. And now he really gets himself into trouble. By and by, the benefits of carnality are overshone by the liabilities. There are times when you might walk away from God and at first it feels pleasurable and relieving and delightful, but after a while the bills come due and you've got to pay the piper, and when you start paying the piper, there's disillusionment. And that's where David finds himself now. Achish believed him, but the princes didn't, and so he is excluded, and he doesn't feel like he can go back to Israel either. He's a displaced person, a man without a country. Where am I going to go? Where is my allegiance? He's neither a Philistine nor an Israelite, really. Also distrusted. People who once trusted him have turned against him, and he's on an island. Making a long story short here, if we go down to chapter 30, it came to pass, verse 1, when David and his men were come to Ziklag on the third day, that the Amalekites had invaded the south and Ziklag and smitten Ziklag and burnt it with fire. This is the place that David had moved to. His family's there. The families of his men are there. And now they come back there, having been out fighting. They come back where their families are supposed to be, and they find their families have been gone, and the town has been burnt down. Verse 2, they had taken the women and made of them captives that were therein. They slew not any, either great or small, but carried them away and went on their way. So David and his men came to the city. Behold, it was burned with fire, and their wives and their sons and their daughters were taken captive. And David and the people that were with him lifted up their voice and wept until they had no more power to weep. If you've ever wept that long, you know how that feels, to cry until you don't have any more tears. David and his men were at their extreme urgency in life. Their families are gone. Our families mean so much to us. So they're distressed. They're depressed. And they're even talking about stoning David for getting them into this. Verse 5, David's two wives were taken captive, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess and Abigail the wife of Nabal the Carmelite. David was greatly distressed, verse 6, for the people spoke of stoning him because the soul of the people was grieved, every man for his sons and his daughters. But David encouraged himself in the Lord his God. And that last statement there in the last phrase of verse 6 is what I wanted to get to. Finally, when there wasn't anywhere else to turn, David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. Finally here, he chooses the right road. There's nobody there to counsel him. He's absolutely alone in the ruins of Ziklag. All his crutches are gone. Even his own men have turned against him and may be killing him any time. Finally, David looks up for the first time in 16 months. Dark days call for right thinking and vertical focus, looking up to God. Finally, David found that depression was not designed to throw him on his back, but to bring him to his knees, to bring him closer to God. And once he turns and talks to God, then everything goes right for David again. Long story short, down in verse 8, David is told, pursue, and you shall surely overtake those that have taken your families, and you shall without fail recover all. This is when David inquired of the Lord. The Lord told him this probably through the Urim and the Thummim that a priest had. You shall recover all. And then down in verse 18, we see David recovered all. In verse 19 as well, at the end of 19, David recovered all. The Lord always invariably turns pessimism into optimism if we stay with him. So few things matter if we just stay with the Lord. He will invariably turn pessimism into optimism. And then in the next chapter, chapter 31, Saul dies and David then is very close to becoming the next king and does become the next king. And 2 Samuel tells the story of David's life as king. It's a change from pessimism into optimism from the story of David. And that can be the story of each one of our lives as well. If you're outside of Jesus Christ today, we have had a lesson from the Old Testament. In the New Testament, we see the story of Jesus who came and died for our sins. Without Jesus Christ, there's nothing but pessimism. We would be extremely pessimistic people. He's the only one who can change pessimism into optimism that is also realistic. Because that time that he came out of the grave, one time, once for all people, once for all time, had him conquering the power of death. He died for sin once. That was all that was necessary. And he rose from the dead once. And because he will never die again, we need never die again. If you're outside of Christ today and we come to Him in simple trusting faith, repenting of your sins, confessing Him, being immersed in water for the remission of your sins, we would invite you to come. If you have anything else to bring before the brethren assembled here today, please let us know how we can assist you by coming to one of these front seats as we stand together, and Denny's going to lead us in one last song.